Despite having no formal diplomatic relations since the 1980s, Iran and the United States can't seem to get enough of each other. That love-to-hate relationship was cranked up another level with the withdrawal of the U.S. from the Iran nuclear deal, the reimposing of sanctions, and the increased economic pressure the United States has been placing on other countries, forcing them not to deal with Iran. As powder continues to be added to the keg, it seems like every day we inch closer to a military conflict with Iran. In this episode of Lessons from the Screen, we will be looking at the 65-year history and the growing issues between Iran and the United States. Lessons from the Screen, what we mean is we go through different documentaries to tell you what they gon' do. Give you our lessons, give them our blessings. If they trash, we tell you there is no second guessing. Knowledge is power, but time is precious. And we're here to keep you running with lessons. So sit back as we groove, giving you the review, so you only spend time on the docs that you need to. Welcome to another episode of Lessons from the Screen, where we give you a review of whether or not whatever it is that you're looking at on any screen of any kind is worth your time. We waste our time, our energy, and our brain power so that you don't have to. You're welcome. Lessons for the Screen is sponsored by PacSync, a black activist advocacy and think tank organization with the purpose of increasing the quality of life for black people in America through education, a culture shift, and economics. Check them out at www.pactsinc.org. That's www.pactsinc.org. Go ahead. You know the spiel. Leave a review. Become a member. Become a donation. Give a donation. Tell a friend to tell a friend. Take a survey. Go into the Learning Center. Read a book. Tell a friend to tell a friend to go into the Learning Center to read a book and then leave a donation after you take a survey. It's all there for you people. Check them out. Do what you can to help them because they're doing what they can to help you. Since the 1980s, since 1980, not the 80s, since 1980, Iran and the U.S. haven't had formal diplomatic relations. That means that the U.S. doesn't have an ambassador to Iran or an embassy in the country, and Iran doesn't have either to the U.S. or in the U.S. Pakistan serves as a protecting power for Iran and the U.S., and Switzerland serves as a protecting power for the U.S. and Iran. A protecting power represents a state in a country that has no diplomatic relationship with the state. It is responsible for looking after the property and the people of the appointing state. But there were formal relations before that between Iran and the United States. So when did the relationship go sour? Well, if you've been listening to this show for any length of time, you know that when we cover current events, we go all the way back. So we finna go all the way back. So going back to when Iran was known as Persia, the introduction of the U.S.-Iran relationship was started in 1856 when Persia sent an ambassador to Washington, D.C. Roughly 30 years later, in 1883, the U.S. sent an official diplomatic envoy to Iran. It wasn't until 1944 that official ambassadorial relationships were established. But despite various requests by Persia seeking U.S. assistance, the U.S. was largely uninterested in the country until after World War II, although interactions between the countries remained polite. While Persia sought to remove the influence and power of the British and the Russians in their affairs in the early 1900s, the U.S. became an attractive place for many Iranians. Iranians at the time that the nation was known as Persia, Iranians were the larger culture group in the region. So even though the nation, the state of the land was called Persia, the people were still referred to as some derivative of Iranian. Anyways, moving forward. This was also around the same time that Persia was undergoing a constitutional revolution, which would eventually lead to the country's first parliament. Barring a few hiccups, the two countries remained on friendly terms until the 1950s. In 1951, Mohammad Mossadegh assumed his title as the 35th prime minister of Iran after winning what was cleared as a fair and democratic election. With his election came sweeping reforms, the biggest of which was his administration's goal of nationalizing the Iranian oil industry. The industry had been built up by the British over time, starting in 1913 through the Anglo-Persian Oil Company, APOC or AIOC, which would eventually come to be known as British Petroleum or BP. The deal between the two governments at the start of the development was that Britain would take 85% of the profits from Iranian Persian oil, while the Persians, the Iranians, would get the remaining 15%. Mossadegh claimed that Iran was the rightful owner of all the oil in Iran, and he believed that Britain's control over the oil company gave it power and influence over the Iranian sovereign nation. By this view, nationalizing the company was a necessary step in making Iran a true independent nation, and the profits could be used to strengthen the government and the nation without the need for outside assistance. This move really bothered Britain, and though U.S. President Truman expressed his support of Iran and Mossadegh continued to express his support for the U.S., the CIA was undertaking operations to destabilize Mossadegh's administration. Some claim that this was being done without Truman's knowledge. As Mossadegh continued to press forward with his nationalization agenda, Britain responded by effectively blocking the sale of Iranian oil in the international markets, and with the removal of British expertise from the company, Iranian oil production virtually stopped, and the oil that was being produced was impossible to sell. Oil production dropped from 246 million barrels in 1951 to 11 million barrels in 1952. And the oil income from 1951 to 1954 was reduced to almost nothing. The British shifted their oil production focus to Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Iraq, and other countries so that the British people did not experience any hardship at all. In 1953, Truman was replaced by Eisenhower as president of the U.S. and began taking even more actions to destabilize the Mossadegh administration. As the Cold War between the U.S. and the USSR intensified, the U.S. developed fears that the Iranian government would shift to communism. These fears seemed to be very valid as the Republic of China experienced an internal struggle and reemerged as the People's Republic of China. The country had essentially gone from being a democratic republic with many similarities to the U.S. to being a communist state. The fear of Iran becoming a communist state was also spurred on by the fact that oil negotiations between Britain and Iran were stalling. So in the summer of 1953, the U.S. and Britain launched a joint covert operation codenamed Ajax with the goal of overthrowing the Mossadegh administration. It failed at first, but another attempt was launched, which was successful, resulting in Mossadegh's imprisonment. With Mossadegh out of the way, the U.S. helped reinstate the Shah, a title previously held by the monarchs of Persia, Mohammad Reza, who had also fled the country during the coup attempts, on the promise that he would appoint a prime minister favorable to the U.S. The Shah, fearing that the appointed general would overthrow him, similar to how his own father, a general, overthrew the previous dynasty's last Shah in order to set up the dynasty he was a part of, began maneuvering to claim true power for himself. Playing off the conflicts of his own nation's elites and the misgivings of the British and the U.S., in addition to his own image as a coward and an airhead, he managed to achieve his goal of true power. With the U.S. backing him and delivering more than $1 billion over a decade, the Shah implemented sweeping changes across the nation, and the U.S. and Iran became extremely close allies. The U.S. helped the Shah form a secret police to keep him in power, and in 1957, the U.S. kickstarted Iran's nuclear program by providing the country's first nuclear reactor and nuclear fuel. In 1967, the U.S. provided weapons-grade enriched uranium, Iran adopted the U.S. model for universities for its own schools, and the Shah received praise from many U.S. presidents for its sweeping reforms. In 1979, undercover unrest in Iran exploded to the surface as many felt like the Shah was too cozy with the U.S. and felt that he was compromising their country and their culture. Members of the revolution were wary of the CIA and took steps to make sure that the U.S. couldn't prevent their uprising. Consequently, 6 months before the uprising, the CIA released a report saying there was no indication that an uprising was imminent or that unrest was at a level of concern. The Shah was replaced with the anti-American Supreme Leader Ruhollah Khomeini. Later in 1979, feeling that their fears about the Shah being an American puppet were confirmed when he and his allies were allowed safe haven in the U.S., a revolutionary group occupied the American embassy in Tehran and took diplomats hostage. 52 diplomats were held hostage for 444 days. There was also the fear that the U.S. was planning another coup from the embassy. And this was the embassy that the coup in 1953 was planned and executed from. In 1980, the U.S. attempted a military rescue that resulted in 8 dead soldiers and no hostages released. The mission was aborted. In 1980, the U.S. severed diplomatic relations between the countries and they have been frozen ever since. The U.S. embassy was not given over to Switzerland in the traditional fashion with regards to a protecting power. I talked about that earlier. But parts of the embassy were turned into an anti-American museum and other parts became offices for student organizations. Following the hostage crisis, the U.S. went from being Iran's biggest economic and military partner to opposing Iran at every turn. During the 1980s, the U.S. tried to play both sides of the fence during the Iran-Iraq War. The U.S. also asserted that Iran was responsible for several embassy attacks through its client Hezbollah. There was also the Iran-Contra affair during which Reagan attempted to get Iran to use its influence to release American hostages held in Lebanon. The Reagan administration hoped to sell arms to Iran in order to improve relations with the country. They would then funnel the money from the sale to Contra rebels in Nicaragua. However, the Reagan officials refused to hand over the necessary documentation to investigators during an investigation of the affair. The U.S. also launched Operation Praying Mantis against Iran, which was the largest American naval combat operation since World War II. Iran lost a warship and a gunboat during the operation and suffered damage to several oil production facilities. They sued for reparations from the U.S. in the International Courts of Justice, but the courts dismissed the case. In 1991, the Bush administration said that it would take several steps to ease economic pressure on Iran if they helped facilitate the release of American hostages held by Hezbollah. After the hostages were released, the Bush administration did not do anything to ease economic pressure on Iran. In 1995, Clinton ended growing trade with Iran by imposing a total embargo on Iran, which was followed up by the Iran-Libya Sanctions Act passed by Congress to prevent other countries from making large investments in Iranian energy. Other countries announced their displeasure and some outright dismissed it. After the September 11th Twin Towers attack, Iranian citizens lit candles and had vigils in front of the Swedish embassy. The Supreme Leader also suspended his Death to America chants in a show of support as he blasted terrorism. A few months later in 2002, Baby Bush gave a speech in which he included Iran in with other countries labeled as the axis of evil. The U.S. also began launching unmanned drones into Iran from Iraq on intelligence gathering operations. In 2003, the U.S. really started to take note of Iran's nuclear weapons program. While Iran contended that its nuclear capabilities were only being refined for power generation. However, the U.S. imposed considerable pressure on the international bodies to sanction Iran for violation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. While Iran was in violation for failure to adequately document and report nuclear material, the U.S. was also in violation for failure to disarm nuclear weapons under one of the articles of the treaty. While Iran and the U.S. have announced at various times a willingness to speak to each other, the U.S. has continued covert operations in Iran and open military operations against Iranian facilities in other nations, such as the raid on Iran's consulate general in Iraq. When Barack Obama became president, Iran issued its first congratulatory message to a U.S. president since 1979. And Barack Obama issued a statement to the Muslim world of new opportunities that many in the U.S. viewed as proof that he was a Muslim and working for the Muslim state in the Middle East. During Obama's tenure, there were a number of drone incidents involving U.S. drones being captured or destroyed in Iranian airspace. And a lot of people refer to President Barack Obama as the Drone King or some other derivative of a drone nickname, because he was quite fond of using drones whenever, wherever, and however he could. And his reasoning for that was oftentimes that he would rather put an unmanned piece of equipment in harm's way than actual troops, which some on the right have criticized him as being weak for doing that. But anyways, moving on. In 2015, what would come to be known as the Iran nuclear deal was agreed to. The Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPA, was a deal struck by the US, the UK, Russia, China, France, Germany, Iran, and the European Union. The Obama administration agreed to lift sanctions on Iran if Iran gave up their nuclear capabilities and allowed inspections of their nuclear sites by UN agents at will. Obama couldn't get congressional support for the deal, so he enacted the agreement as an executive action. In 2017, with the election of Donald Trump, Iranian citizens were temporarily banned from the U.S. Trump didn't like the deal, the Iran nuclear deal, and even though he certified that the Iran government was in compliance in April of 2017, in July of 2017, Congress passed the Countering America's Adversaries Through Sanctions Act that grouped sanctions against Iran, Russia, and North Korea, which was viewed by the Iranians as a violation of the nuclear deal that they had signed with President Obama. And in May of 2018, Trump pulled the U.S. out of the nuclear deal, even though all certifying bodies and American intelligence officials and President Trump cabinet members were saying that the Iranian government was not in violation of the agreement. The rest of the members of the agreement agreed to continue in the agreement, and Iran continued, hoping that the others would offset any losses from the U.S. leaving the deal and imposing sanctions. However, when the U.S. left the deal and began reimposing sanctions, they also put new restrictions in place that would also sanction any government or corporation that did business with Iran, placing all the other members of the agreement in a delicate position. In 2019, the U.S. designated Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps as a terrorist organization, and Iran retaliated by designating the U.S. military as a terrorist group. The U.S. also ended its waiver program that allowed countries with waivers to purchase Iranian oil without having to worry about U.S. sanctions for doing so. The U.S. also sent an aircraft carrier and bomber planes to the Persian Gulf, which is said was in response to an escalation by the Iranian government. The Iranian government gave a 60-day warning that if it did not get relief from U.S. sanctions, it would violate the agreement and begin enriching uranium, getting closer to a nuclear bomb. On May 13, 2019, four oil tankers were attacked, with the U.S. accusing Iran and Iran denying the accusations. The U.S. sent 1,500 troops and other military resources to the Middle East to counter Iran. And in June of 2019, two more oil tankers were attacked in the same area, with the U.S. again blaming Iran and Iran again claiming innocence. A week later, on June 17th, Iran announced that it was 10 days away from surpassing the limit set by the nuclear deal, and the U.S. announced that it was sending another 1,000 troops to the Middle East. on June 20th, Iran shot down a military drone, which it claimed was in Iranian airspace, while the U.S. claimed it was in international airspace. The next day, President Trump tweeted that he called off an airstrike against Iran 10 minutes before the attack, instead opting to retaliate in the form of cyber attacks against Iran. The cyber attacks were meant to take Iranian military assets offline for a period of time. And things continue to get worse. July has been a hotbed of activity, with Iran seizing a British tanker in response to Britain seizing an Iranian tanker. The U.S. shot down an Iranian drone for flying too close. The British have deployed naval forces to the area to ensure the safety of transport ships in the region, a region which supports 30% of the total global oil trade. And Iran continues to demand sanctions relief from the other signatories to the nuclear deal, while the U.S. continues to demand the other nations abandon the deal. China and Russia have continued to trade with Iran, although at lesser levels, and the European Union has been working on a barter system that would allow trade in the region without violating U.S. sanctions. Meanwhile, Iran has also continued to enrich uranium above the levels permitted by the nuclear deal as a means of asserting more and more pressure. And given how things have turned out, with North Korea developing nuclear weapons as a deterrent against regime change and being ignored, many people fear that the U.S. will initiate military action against Iran to keep them from becoming a nuclear state in the way that it was failed to do with North Korea. If that happens, given the importance of trade in that area and the amount of oil that flows through the areas controlled by Iran, major damage could be done to global trade and economics in nations all over the world, and the U.S. would potentially drive an even bigger wedge between itself and its allies, whilst also shoving other nations into partnerships with China and Russia as an alternative to partnering with the U.S., something that is already happening in increasing numbers. While America might win a military contest against Iran, it would certainly suffer greatly for years to come. And this has been another episode of Lessons from the Screen. I will see you next week.
Lessons from the Screen, what we mean is we go through different documentaries to tell you what they gon' do. Give you our lessons, give them our blessings. If they trash, we tell you there is no second guessing. Knowledge is power, but time is precious. And we're here to keep you from them lessons. So sit back as we groove, giving you the review, so you only spend time on the docs that you need to.
All right, I want to thank you guys once again for tuning in to Lessons from the Screen right here on the Freedom Train Network. Remember to go show the Freedom Train Network some love, www.freedomtrainradio.com, spelled just like it sounds. If you can't spell it, I don't know what to tell you. But make sure you also go ahead and check out the Freedom Train Radio app. If you got an Android, we got an app. And if you got an Android and your Android ain't got the app on it, then you ain't cool. And that's all I'm going to say about that. It's in the App Store. Search Freedom Train Radio. You'll see the logo, the Choo Choo Train, calling your name. So go ahead and get that there. Make sure you show all of the Freedom Train Radio Network shows some love. Give them all a hug. Leave a comment on all of the shows that you like. And even the shows that you don't like, leave a comment still telling them you don't like them and you don't like they suck a fish fried eggs. And I also want to take more time to tell you guys to go and check out our sponsors, PAX Inc., PACTSINC.org, PAXINC.org. Show them some love. And drop a line on the Freedom Train website. Let us know what you like. Let us know what you don't like. Let us know what you want to hear. Let us know what shows you think we should try to put together for you. The number one, the world's first black, pro-black podcast directory right here. You know what it is. You know what it does. And we look forward to seeing you, hearing from you, speaking with you, and sharing life with you every week. I will see you next week. This is your boy, Patrick Irvin.